Friday, as the high tracks to the east, warmer conditions on the backside of the high will filter into the Midwest, allowing pleasant conditions to be seen across the region. High temperatures today will range from around 30 degrees across northern Wisconsin to the mid-50s in southeastern Missouri and western Kentucky. Overnight low temperatures will range from the teens across northern Wisconsin and northwestern Iowa to the mid-30s across southeastern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny with a high of 45. The wind from the north at 10 to 15. Miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries after midnight. Expect a low of 25. The wind will be out of the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny, the high 42. The wind from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low of 28. The wind will be out of the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts after midnight to 25 miles per hour. Friday, sunny and windy. We'll see a high in the low 50s. The wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Saturday, mostly cloudy. Look for a high in the upper 50s. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. We'll see a low Saturday night in the mid 40s. Let's take a look at temperatures around the region at noon. Chicago reported 40 degrees. At Rockford, it was 39. In Bloomington, 41. In Carbondale, 49 degrees. At Willard Airport, it was 43 degrees at the top of the hour. The dew point, 24. The relative humidity, 47%. The wind out of the north at 18. The barometric pressure, 30.08 and falling. And let's look now at some temperatures in Indiana. At Indianapolis, 48 degrees at the top of the hour. Lafayette reported 44 degrees. At South Bend, 42 degrees. And Terre Haute checked in with 48 degrees. And at 12:39, 42 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky, partly sunny. One of Japan's most venerable corporations is facing possible bankruptcy, and its executives face jail time. The corporate scandal has stunned the nation. Olympus, a maker of cameras and medical equipment that is a household name in Japan, has been cooking its books and covering losses dating back to the 1990s. Lucy Kraft reports from Tokyo.
Olympus Corporation has been in business for almost a century, and while not as famous overseas as Toyota, Sony, or Nintendo, until recently, no company seemed to more perfectly embody its own name. In one way or another, Olympus products reach nearly every Japanese citizen. While its digital cameras are losing ground, the company has carved out a reputation for technical excellence in medical equipment. So when news broke that for 20 years, Olympus executives had been cooking the books, that the company may be in hock for over $1 billion, Christina Amagian, who studies corporate governance in Japan, couldn't believe her ears.
Complete shock. It just didn't compute that something, I mean, the reputation of Olympus has been such a high quality, good, responsible company that hearing this just did not compute at all.
Japanese police and financial regulators are still sorting out the mess, but observers say it all began in the mid-1980s. Olympus began to founder after moves to weaken the dollar suddenly made Japanese exports less competitive. Anxious to beef up its bottom line, Olympus followed the crowd, according to Shuhei Abe, president of the Sparks Group hedge fund.
They went into what they call Zaitek, that's financially investing their idle cash to make up their slowing down earnings.
And this was quite common among many
Japanese. It was very common. Everyone did it, and if you didn't do it, management were considered to be a bit outdated.
But when Japan's bubble economy burst, and later when finance regulators tightened rules on accounting, Olympus didn't do what most other Japanese companies did. It never came clean on its losses, choosing instead to hide its mistakes with a series of overpriced acquisitions using Cayman Islands-based companies. The Olympus scandal has reinvigorated the debate over Japan's corporate governance. Most companies in the world's third largest economy have refused to put independent directors on their boards. Koji Aiba of Tokyo's Waseda University says the lack of oversight allows a Japanese CEO to ignore his shareholders with impunity.
He picks the board members from his subordinates, and he has the power to shuffle the board member. And when he goes to the shareholder meeting, he already has a proxy of more than 50% in his hand, so he doesn't really have to care.
The insider mentality at Olympus is reminiscent also of Tokyo Electric Power, whose Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant became the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Christina Amagian says the overriding instinct at such firms is to hide mistakes at all costs.
The sense that we must be loyal to our predecessors, that we can't blow the whistle, we can't criticize because of these bonds of loyalty are very similar. That's very Japanese culture.
Japan has been moving towards better disclosure in recent years. The Olympus debacle, which has put Japanese corporate governance under global scrutiny, won't transform standards overnight. It's widely expected to at least hasten moves towards reform. For NPR News, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
It's 12:43. The scandal at Penn State seems to be leading other abuse victims to come forward. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports people all across the country with no ties to the university are contacting lawyers and revealing secrets they've kept for years. This report contains content some listeners may find disturbing.
The man said the advances began when he was 10 years old. He was a fourth grader and altar boy at a Catholic school in Hudson, Massachusetts. He says the priest would try to touch the altar boys when they were putting on their robes, and he'd invite them to the rectory one at a time.
And he'd want to show us pornographic magazines and ask us to take our pants down, and he'd take his pants down and expose himself and things like that.
The man, who asked not to be identified, told the nuns that something was wrong with the priest, but they didn't believe him. For 38 years, he stayed silent, even after the Catholic sex abuse scandal broke a decade ago. But when he saw the allegations against former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, something snapped.
It hit home for me because I have a son that's that age.
His 10-year-old son is a star hockey player, and already the boy is being scouted by coaches in junior high school. Watching the Penn State story unfold, he thought,
wait a minute, you know, this is some guy who's using his power as a football coach, you know, to lure boys in, but hey, look, we're going to go have some fun.
And you look at that and you thought, that could be my son.
It happened to me. It could happen to my son.
So last week, he picked up the phone and called a lawyer.
Without a doubt, there's a domino effect.
That's the man's attorney, Mitchell Garabedian. He says 10 to 15 people called him last week, saying they were prompted by Penn State. Garabedian says in the Catholic sex abuse crisis, there have been few repercussions for church officials. But in the Penn State case, there have already been consequences. Penn State's legendary coach, Joe Paterno, was fired, and two administrators were indicted for perjury. Garabedian says all this encouraged victims to come forward.
What happened at Penn State is further validation. Validation that the victim did nothing wrong, the victim should not feel guilty, the victim should not be ashamed, the victim should not feel alone.
Several attorneys told NPR they've seen a spike in phone calls from people with long-buried secrets. Kelly Clark, an attorney in Portland, Oregon, says about 30 of them came forward last week with stories of abuse by Boy Scout leaders, Catholic priests, Mormon leaders, and family members. Clark says the events at Penn State have motivated a larger and more diverse group than previous church scandals have because a sports scandal reaches a larger audience.
They're sitting in front of their TV expecting to see football, and they got all child abuse all the time right in their face.
Clark says Jerry Sandusky's interview with NBC will only fan the flames. The former coach admitted to taking showers and roughhousing naked with boys, but he said he had no sexual intent and he was innocent of the charges.
I've already had one email from a client saying, are you kidding me? He thinks he's going to get away with that. I showered with them and I played around with them and I'm just a big old kid, but I didn't do anything sexual. Yeah, denial by the institutions and denial by the perpetrators tends to send child abuse victims into orbit.
And Clark says he expects more people to call him in the days to come. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Commentator Frank DeFord wonders if the very nature of the sport of football contributed to the events at Penn State.
As confounding as was the failure of Penn State officials to act, the consensus explaining the motives for their ignoble behavior is that, first, Joe Paterno didn't want to scar the reputation of himself or his football program, and then university executives wanted to protect the reputation of the dear old coach and his money-making team. Yet I must wonder as well how much the culture of the particular sport involved, football, abetted the conspiracy of silence. Football, you see, is our proud American throwback showcase of men being at their best, most primitive masculine. Indeed, the question of whether the sport is too brutal has always been an issue, and nowadays, of course, the subject is as prominent as ever. And always, always, the defenders of football are furious that the violence might be curtailed by do-gooders, that football will be sissified. The expression heard from the time little boys first play is that football teaches you to become a real man, to be manly. Nobody ever says that about even the most sublime baseball or basketball players. The only North American school sport that approaches football in its meanness is ice hockey. And yes, maybe just coincidentally, hockey has also experienced horrifying cases of pedophile coaches which went unreported for years. How could anyone possibly believe an abused boy that such a manly sport could produce such sexually perverted men? For football's devotees, the sport is public proof that our American men are still tougher than anyone else. Because of that reputation of machismo, that conceit, that creed, it surely becomes painful, almost traitorous, for men who love football to accept such an abject contradiction of their sport's manliness, the very rape of a little boy by a coach. Perhaps it doesn't even matter why Joe Paterno could be so insensitive and irresponsible. Even Paterno himself may not know what caused him to fail such a basic test of decency. But still, I cannot help but wonder that, no, it wasn't primarily because of his own reputation, but because of all the money Penn State football made that stopped him from acting. No, I wonder if, above all, Coach Paterno could not bear to see shame come to his beloved game of football.
Morning Edition sports commentator Frank DeFord.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 16th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of the fiction author Andrea Barrett, born Boston, 1954. Andrea Barrett, who said, "I've never known a writer who didn't feel ill at ease in the world. We all feel unhoused in some